You know, when I was 15 years old, I used to wonder how any man could become a criminal. I couldn't understand what would make it possible. Now I'm glad that Ron Yardanishold has blown up those mills. May God bless him and never let them find him, whatever and wherever he is. Yes, that's what I've come to feel. Well, how much do they think people can take? It's not so bad for me in the daytime because I can keep busy and not think, but it gets me at night. I can't sleep anymore. I lie awake for hours. Yes, if you want to know it, yes, it's because I'm worried about her. I'm scared to death for her. Woodstock is just a miserable little hole of a place miles away from anything, and the Taggart Lodge is 20 miles farther, 20 miles of a twisting trail in a godforsaken forest. How do I know what might happen to her there, alone, and with the kind of gangs that are roving all through the country these nights? Just through such desolate parts of the country as the Berkshires. I know I shouldn't think about it. I know that she can take care of herself, only I wish she'd drop me a line. I wish I could go there. But she told me not to. I told her I'd wait. You know, I'm glad you're here tonight. It helps me talking to you and just seeing you here. You won't vanish like all the others, will you? What? Next week? Oh, on your vacation. For how long? How do you rate a whole month's vacation? I wish I could do that, too, take a month off at my own expense. But they wouldn't let me. Really? I envy you. I wouldn't have envied you a few years ago. But now? Now I'd like to get away. Now I envy you. If you've been able to take a month off every summer for 12 years. It was a dark road, but it led in a new direction. Reardon walked from his mills, not toward his house, but toward the city of Philadelphia. It was a great distance to walk, but he had wanted to do it tonight, as he had done it every evening of the past week. He felt at peace in the empty darkness of the countryside, with nothing but the black shapes of trees around him, with no motion but that of his own body, and of branches stirring in the wind, with no lights but the slow sparks of the fireflies flickering through the hedges. The 2 hours between mills and city were his span of rest. He had moved out of his home to an apartment in Philadelphia. He had given no explanation to his mother and Philip. He had said nothing except that they could remain in the house if they wished, and that Miss Ives would take care of their bills. He had asked them to tell Lillian when she returned that she was not to attempt to see him. They had stared at him in terrified silence. He had handed to his attorney a signed blank check and said, "Get me a divorce, on any grounds and at any cost. I don't care what means you use, how many of their judges you purchase, or whether you find it necessary to stage a frame-up of my wife. Do whatever you wish. But there is to be no alimony and no property settlement." The attorney had looked at him with the hint of a wise, sad smile, as if this were an event he had expected to happen long ago. He had answered, "Okay, Hank, it can be done, but it will take some time. Make it as fast as you can." No one had questioned him about his signature on the gift certificate, but he had noticed that the men at the mills looked at him with a kind of searching curiosity, almost as if they expected to find the scars of some physical torture on his body. He felt nothing. Nothing but the sense of an even, restful twilight, like a spread of slag over a molten metal when it crusts and swallows the last brilliant spurt of the white glow within. He felt nothing at the thought of the looters who were now going to manufacture Reardon metal. His desire to hold his right to it, and proudly to be the only one to sell it, had been his form of respect for his fellow men, his belief that to trade with them was an act of honor. The belief, the respect, and the desire were gone. He did not care what men made, what they sold, where they bought his metal, or whether any of them would know that it had been his. The human shapes moving past him in the streets of the city were physical objects without any meaning. The countryside, with the darkness washing away all traces of human activity, leaving only an untouched earth which he had once been able to handle, was real. He carried a gun in his pocket, as advised by the policemen of the radio car that patrolled the roads. They had warned him that no road was safe after dark these days. He felt, with a touch of mirthless amusement, that the gun had been needed at the mills, not in the peaceful safety of loneliness and night. What could some starving vagrant take from him, compared to what had been taken by men who claimed to be his protectors? He walked with an effortless speed, feeling relaxed by a form of activity that was natural to him. This was his period of training for solitude, he thought. He had to learn to live without any awareness of people, the awareness that now paralyzed him with revulsion. He had once built his fortune, starting out with empty hands. Now he had to rebuild his life, starting out with an empty spirit. He would give himself a short span of time for the training, he thought, and then he would claim the one incomparable value still left to him, the one desire that had remained pure and whole. He would go to Dagny. Two commandments had grown in his mind. One was a duty, the other a passionate wish. The first was never to let her learn the reason of his surrender to the looters. The second was to say to her the words which he should have known at their first meeting, and should have said on the gallery of Ellis Wyatt's house. There was nothing but the strong summer starlight to guide him as he walked, but he could distinguish the highway and the remnant of a stone fence ahead at the corner of a country crossroad. The fence had nothing to protect any longer, only a spread of weeds, a willow tree bending over the road, and farther in the distance, the ruin of a farmhouse with the starlight showing through its roof. He walked, thinking that even this sight still retained the power to be of value. It gave him the promise of a long stretch of space undisturbed by human intrusion. The man who stepped suddenly out into the road must have come from behind the willow tree, but so swiftly that it seemed as if he had sprung up from the middle of the highway. Reardon's hand went to the gun in his pocket, but stopped. He knew, by the proud posture of the body standing in the open, by the straight line of the shoulders against the starlit sky, that the man was not a bandit. When he heard the voice, he knew that the man was not a beggar. "I should like to speak to you, Mr. Reardon." The voice had the firmness, the clarity, and the special courtesy peculiar to men who are accustomed to giving orders. "Go ahead," said Reardon, "provided you don't intend to ask me for help or money." The man's garments were rough, but efficiently trim. He wore dark trousers and a dark blue windbreaker, closed tight at his throat, prolonging the lines of his long, slender figure. He wore a dark blue cap, and all that could be seen of him in the night were his hands, his face, and a patch of gold blonde hair on his temple. The hands held no weapon, only a package wrapped in burlap, the size of a carton of cigarettes. "No, Mr. Reardon," he said, "I don't intend to ask you for money, but to return it to you."
"To return money?"
"Yes."
"What money?"
"A small refund on a very large debt."
"Owed by you?"
"No, not by me. It is only a token payment, but I want you to accept it as proof that if we live long enough, you and I, every dollar of that debt will be returned to you."
"What debt?"
"The money that was taken from you by force."
He extended the package to Reardon, flipping the burlap open. Reardon saw the starlight run like fire along a mirror-smooth surface. He knew by its weight and texture that what he held was a bar of solid gold. He looked from the bar to the man's face, but the face seemed harder and less revealing than the surface of the metal.
"Who are you?" asked Reardon.
"The friend of the friendless."
"Did you come here to give this to me?"
"Yes."
"Do you mean that you had to stalk me at night on a lonely road in order not to rob me, but to hand me a bar of gold?"
"Yes."
"Why?"
"When robbery is done in open daylight by sanction of the law, as it is done today, then any act of honor or restitution has to be hidden underground."
"What made you think that I'd accept a gift of this kind?"
"It is not a gift, Mr. Reardon. It is your own money.
But I have one favor to ask of you. It is a request, not a condition, because there can be no such thing as conditional property. The gold is yours, so you are free to use it as you please. But I risked my life to bring it to you tonight. So I am asking as a favor that you save it for the future, or spend it on yourself, on nothing but your own comfort and pleasure. Do not give it away, and above all, do not put it into your business."
"Why?"
"Because I don't want it to be of any benefit to anybody but you. Otherwise, I will have broken an oath taken long ago. as I am breaking every rule I had set for myself by speaking to you tonight.
What do you mean?
I have been collecting this money for you for a long time, but I did not intend to see you or tell you about it or give it to you until much later.
Then why did you?
Because I couldn't stand it any longer.
Stand what?
I thought that I had seen everything one could see and that there was nothing I could not stand seeing. But when they took Reardon metal away from you, it was too much, even for me. I know that you don't need this gold at present. What you need is the justice which it represents, and the knowledge that there are men who care for justice.